HPPodcraft.com.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackey, and we are at HPPodcraft.com.
But if you're listening to this, you are listening on Patreon. Thank you so much for supporting, and we've been reading your comments on the stories over the last couple months, and now we want to read them out loud so that you can enjoy them as well.
Yes, this one is from our topics show, Strategies, and this is back on August 20th.
We got a comment from Ilker Yusel, who's an old friend of the show. Mm-hmm. We had that whole thing where Nimoy was doing the smoke bubbles and Matt Barisi could do the more smoke bubbles and that sort of thing. Uh-huh. Ilker writes, you know, Nimoy was a magician. He played the Great Paris in 2 seasons of Mission Impossible. I don't know if that means Nimoy was a magician or he played one on TV.
If you look at that comment, at the end of it, there's a little winky smile.
Right.
So maybe he wasn't actually a magician, but he played a magician for 2 seasons. So yeah. He must have picked up a few tricks.
I'm sure he picked up a few, and he just seems like the kind of guy that he would know a couple of sleight of hand tricks, you know, that would be in the repertoire. So.
Of course.
But thank you, Ilker. I didn't realize that.
Stephen Vincent says, I had no idea Leonard Nimoy was a fellow magician and, like me, a master of the classic bubbles from the empty hat trick. P.S. I can do 7.
Whoa.
What?
That is a bold claim, Stephen Vincent.
Well, there's this thing called YouTube. I want to see those 7 bubbles.
Yep, let's see them. It's got to be one long take, too. Don't use... Because there's a lot of people, I don't know if you noticed this online, who do bubble from the hat tricks, and they use, like, After Effects, and you know, it's all this CGI.
Digital trickery. Yeah. It's all BS. Or they've got somebody shooting bubbles out from behind, you know, like mm-hmm. practical effects.
Yes.
But if it wasn't a camera... then you would totally see what was going on. And it's, it's ridiculous.
I mean, when you first go into film school, they take you back, they go, this is how they used forced perspective to do the smoke bubble trick back in 1923. That's right. And that's something that you got to watch and learn.
You've got to watch. So, Mr. Vincent, mm-hmm. you need to put your bubbles where your mouth is.
That's right. That old phrase. Phil Esterbrook writes, Leonard Nimoy, enraged at his smoke bubble trick has been trumped, releases his dogs on Matt.
Yeah.
Slinging his hat away, Matt reveals that it is indeed true that the only thing he is better at than creating 5 smoke bubbles is vanquishing canines in Mortal Kombat.
All true.
Sure. I mean, in the scenario, Nimoy didn't have dogs, but he is a powerful magician, so he might have done that show me your pussy trick where he lifted his... Because in this scenario, he was wearing a kimono. I don't know if that was obvious, but...
Yes, you did say that,
If he'd opened the kimono and some dogs had just burst out...
That could have happened,
That could have happened.
I mean, from an improvisational standpoint, Chad, that was kind of a no that you just threw down and not a yes and.
Well...
Just saying.
Sometimes that's more fun.
Okay. Stacey Swanee... She asks a question. She says, were you guys high when you did this show? I can only speak for myself. I was not.
No, I wasn't high. Just high on talking about smoke bubbles. Make America Great Old Ones Again writes, never go for the immortality unless it's the Dracula sort. Because remember, we were asking about that.
Right, yeah.
Would you be immortal? And it is true. You should impose a lot of conditions, especially if you listen to what he writes here.
Okay.
You really don't want to live forever without a couple of really important extras. One, you don't age and your appearance continues to be that of a typical human.
Yes.
The human body pretty much has an upper limit of 115 years old. And even if you take real good care of it, things start to deteriorate to the point where you really won't be even recognized as human.
Ugh.
Nosferatu, anyone? No, thanks. Plus, of course, everyone else continues to evolve. You don't want to be the weird hairy freak in a silver jumpsuited future of beautiful people. Very true.
That's true, yeah. No, I was assuming that when one is immortal that they would maintain their age, maybe even get younger, maybe become like 35 years old for the rest of your life.
Yeah, you jump to your... best looking self.
Yes.
Whatever age that happens to be. I haven't gotten there yet. So. Number 2, you remain at peak physical ability and are invulnerable to damage of any sort. That's something I didn't really think about. But you really, really, really don't want to live with your limbs rotting off your horribly burned torso, riddled with disease, and the PTSD of having watched everyone you love be destroyed.
Yeah.
Good condition. Didn't think about that.
Good point, yeah.
Number 3, you cannot be trapped. There's nothing worse than falling into a hole and having to live down there for a few millennia.
I mean, that seems unlikely that would happen. And how would you not be... I mean, that kind of implies that you would also have the ability to teleport.
Teleport? Why?
Well, because if you can't be trapped...
Oh, right.
So you would have to be able to get out of any situation. And I think making that stipulation that you can't be trapped, that's a bridge too far. That's an extra superpower, not just immortality. Yeah. I mean, granted, it would be really crappy, but that would be one of the drawbacks to the superpower.
You just have to be...
You just be careful.
You want to go somewhere where there's not wells or...
Caves.
Number four, you can call it quits and decide to die when you want to. Important condition. If you can't do this, then you know what the future holds. The universe dies around you, and still there you are. Even worse than being trapped, you're trapped in the void.
Whoa. Okay, yeah. Now, I would say that it would be important to be able to end your life. So maybe you've got a weakness or invulnerable, but maybe there's something like extreme heat, you know, like an atom bomb or a sun or something like that. You can take a rocket ship into the sun and be destroyed. So yeah, I think of course you should have the ability to end your life.
It's good monkey's paw reasoning, you know. Yeah, anytime you make a wish, there's going to be about 10 unexpected
bad
things that could come with it.
Oh, I'm sure we could make all of these stipulations and then that monkey's paw would come up with something else to get us.
Yeah, something else, right. Which I guess is why this kind of be careful what you wish for thing is a great metaphor for life, because almost everything in our life, no matter how much we hope for it, when it arrives, we go, wow, this is nothing how I thought it was going to be.
Yeah.
You know, all the big moments of life. Doesn't mean they're worse necessarily, but just the fact that wishing for something, when you get it, it's always going to be. It's always going to be different than you expected.
Yeah, yeah.
We did a couple episodes on Don't Look Now.
So Jason Thompson says, I'm glad she changed the original title. John dies at the end.
Very clever. But that would have been a terrible spoiler, so I'm sure Du Maurier knew not to do that. Marcus Lauer wrote, Chad made an interesting point when talking about how we tend to expect all the clues in a story to come together in some kind of final synthesis at the end.
Hmm.
Really, though, randomness is one of the central characteristics of our everyday lives.
Yep.
Now, that's not to say that literature has to mimic this lack of causality in order to be successful, as it operates by its own rules. I find it funny, however, that we tend to equate stories with perfectly explained causalities with the realist tradition, when really they're as artificial and hence untrue to our everyday experience as can be.
Wow, that's a good point.
I mean, we get mad when random things happen in stories.
Yeah.
We're like, wait a minute, I came to this thing because it has some sort of order to it or rules of some kind. Mm-hmm. So if somebody shows up and then they don't pay off in some way, we go, this is badly written.
Yeah.
But it mimics life a lot more than...
Well, I mean, that's, I think, the reason why we want to go to these. I mean, they said the realist tradition.
Yes.
I go to stories to, I don't know, get a sense of justice and purpose and right. Good people will have good things happen to them. Bad people will be punished.
Right.
I like those kinds of stories.
Yeah, that's what we're looking for. We want the bad people to be punished. That's totally true. We want those rats to be eaten by sharks.
Yes. Heck yeah.
This next guy's comment was a response to what I was asking about the rail between mainland Europe and England.
Oh, this is Steve.
Yes.
When I was doing Interrail with my brother back in the distant past, 1983, we got a train from Hamburg to Copenhagen. It was a night train, which we often did to avoid paying for hotels. That's a Lovecraft trick there.
There you go.
We woke up and it was dark and the carriage was empty apart from us too. Also, the train was swaying from side to side. The next few compartments were empty too. Where was everyone? And then as we searched around, we realized that the train was on a boat. We were in the hold. So that's freaky. So when we went up on deck and watched the rest of the short trip from there, apparently you can still do this. And he gives a link to the Copenhagen Baltic Sea train ferry.
That would be really pretty unsettling if you didn't know that was going to happen.
Yeah, for sure.
Jimmy Brune writes, hey guys, great and funny show as always. Thank you, Jimmy.
Oh, thanks.
I actually only knew the Rogue adaptation. I had no idea that it was based on a Du Maurier story, and I watched it when I was a teenager, and it scared the bejesus out of me.
Yeah.
Especially when I still thought that the redheaded figure was a child ghost a la Dark Water. When the reveal came, it gave me a distinct giallo argento-like vibe. Mm-hmm. A bit silly, but scary nonetheless. Yeah, it had that Italian horror bloodiness
when
she cuts him up. Regarding alternative titles for the film in foreign markets, the Danish release was titled Rotschok, meaning Red Shock in English.
Oh.
Not the worst title, I'll grant you, but still one in a long tradition of Danish translations where the Danish version had nothing to do with the original title.
Hmm.
One of the worst offenders has to be the Danish title for the Eastwood Sheen cop movie, The Rookie, which was called Cold Lead and Hot Beatings in Danish.
Oh, that's great.
Cold Lead and Hot Beatings.
Hot that's beatings. Good. That is some good stuff. So Pierce Duncan jumps in on this. He says, my favorite foreign retitling is Dirty Harry, which in China was apparently given the title that translates as Hot-Handed God of Cops. John Woo later reused the title for a movie which was disappointingly translated into English as Hard-Boiled.
Hard-Boiled. I used to watch the crap out of that in college. That was like first exposure to John Woo and that kind of balletic style of gunfighting and stuff that became really popular in Hollywood for a while. But Hot Handed God of Cops is a really good title.
That's a great title.
Ryan Dawson, talking about how the police are always presented as helpful in old Spider-Man comics. That was actually... Were we talking about that in Don't Look Now? Oh, yeah, because the cops were actually helpful in story. Yeah. Ryan Dawson says, talking about how the police are always presented as helpful in old Spider-Man comics, that was actually a specific requirement under the Comics Code Authority, which Marvel didn't really start bucking until the 70s.
Okay.
And he quotes, "Policemen, judges, government officials, and respected institutions shall never be presented in such a way as to create disrespect for established authority."
Of course. That makes perfect sense. I did not know that. I mean, I knew of the Comics Code Authority. I did a report in high school on the Comics Code Authority.
Really?
Mrs. Long allowed me to do that. Yeah.
Oh, cool.
So I did a bunch of research in it. Now that I'm reading it, I remember it, but I totally forgot about that. So thanks, Ryan.
Yeah, that's great to realize. Jerome Arnold writes, "Hello, HBLLP." Hello.
Hello.
"I have been listening to your podcast for many years now, and it has been a treat with every episode. A few episodes back, if I remember right, I thought there was talk of a reading for The Whisperer in Darkness. Is that still or ever was happening?"
Yes.
Yeah, it is. And I'm sorry, it's going to be out in like 3 50-minute editions.
It's long.
We'll release them all at once, but it's really long. And so getting it done on top of the other show load has been difficult, but I'm aiming to have The Whisperer in Darkness out for your Halloween listening. Yes. This October.
It's all recorded. It's been recorded for a while. It's been edited. Chad's finally just putting it all together and making it sound pretty.
He also says, "Has the novel The Invisible Man by H.G. Wells ever lurked onto your itinerary for future episodes?"
Oh, God, yeah.
Heck yeah. I love that James Whale movie, Invisible Man, so much. Top 5, I think, of all time for me.
I got to be honest, I've never read The Invisible Man.
It's such a quick read, too. We could even do it in 2 or 3 weeks, I think. But it's a great book.
Well, I love H.G. Wells.
But yeah, I like the book. I love the movie. So yeah, we'll definitely cover that at some point. And it seems we've hit all the major monster books so far. We got Dracula, Frankenstein. We got to do The Invisible Man.
Yes.
He's up there in the crew of monsters.
Absolutely. Episode 418, this was Copping Squid that we did with Patton Oswalt. Mm-hmm. Caleb Shoggoth-Lord Long says, "Once again, this was fun. Also, Patton really should make That's What Shay Said if ever consistently has enough time free."
Now, did Shoggoth-Lord mishear what Patton said, or is he riffing on his own?
I don't know.
Because Patton said he said Shay Said was going to be his podcast.
Yes.
But That's What Shay Said's a pretty good one. You know, in the room when we were recording that episode.
Yes.
And he riffed on that and said that. I fell out of the discussion for a few minutes because I was sitting there trying to come up with other titles of podcasts covering Michael Shea, and I really drew a blank. So That's What Shea Said would have come in handy.
That would have been great. And Penn is a quick guy. It's almost as if he's a professional comedian.
Seems that way.
Continuing Shoggoth-Lord, he says, "As an aside though, Stalinist communism was super racist, anti-Semitic specifically, also homophobic. Not sure why it isn't remembered so well, but it might be because that deep systemic racism was kind of drowned out in the Western mind by the general omnicidal tendencies of the Stalin regime." Yeah, I think that's what it was all. I mean, because they killed everybody.
Right.
And maybe
I guess we were wrong in saying that, you know, it wasn't that they were equal opportunity. You know, that was kind of a joke. But yeah, of course, they killed people because of their Jewishness, because of their sexuality. But they killed so many other people, too.
They killed lots of people.
But good correction.
Yes.
That's true. Kilberger Yannick writes, "Sadly, not my kind of story," talking about Copping Squid. Mm-hmm. "I didn't know I could do speed reading until now. And still, it was a long 20 minutes.
Oh.
To me, it felt like a sad mix of Pulp Fiction with a tint of Fight Club, Cthulhu t-shirts, and too much nylon. Mm. I had hopes when they got in the car, cruising the city with Mad Andre riding shotgun. Shay almost had me for a few lines there. Then came the downtown scene. Maybe if he'd gone straight to the dog. At one point, it could have gone surreal, but at best, it feels like Terry Pratchett. The bad kind of Terry Pratchett."
Mm, wow.
Sorry about that.
Yeah, sorry. Sorry you didn't like it.
"Is there bad Terry Pratchett? I didn't never heard anybody complain about him. And my only exposure is I read Good Omens, which he did with Neil Gaiman. But,
right. I know Terry Pratchett fans, and I have to admit, I've never read any. I've never even read Good Omens.
Good Omens is a good one. I think they're adapting that in a movie or a series or something like that. They've been trying to for a long time. Some of those Shay stories at first I was a little lukewarm on as well. They felt like... I was going to say like a Delta Green story or something, except I like those Delta Green stories. It's just some of them felt a little fan fiction-y at first.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they were hard for me to get into. But then I did. I don't know. I just made an adjustment. Maybe it's because we had to do a show on them.
Well, maybe it's that they're more modern and you're not used to having modern, not only style of telling stories, but modern settings.
Right.
And that might feel strange. And if you're not used to it, or it could just be you don't like his writing style, which is also
which is fine.
Legitimate. But I enjoy it.
I did like that story.
Hannah Koloff says, went to pick up a copy of Copping Squid on Amazon UK, two used for £924 each. What a bargain. As y'all said, there's always a hustle.
Yeah. Actually, I thought that that the press behind Copping Squid might get a little in on the hustle when they heard us doing these shows and start reprinting the book. But so far, I haven't heard about that.
Well, no, I haven't heard that either. I did see on Shay's website, there is a post about Patton being on our show when he did Zathogua.
Oh, okay, cool.
So the people that run his estate and his website are paying attention. Mm-hmm. I would hope that the publishers would make a new printing of it. I don't remember how I got my copy of it. Did I get it from America? No, I think I got it here. I paid like $25. I mean, it's a lot for a hardcover, hardcover book. But I'm looking for it now. I can't even find...
Did you actually get a hard copy of it?
Yeah.
I thought you were only reading the Kindle version.
No, they have Kindle versions of the stories as well. But no, I got a hard copy.
Yeah, mine wasn't too bad. It was like $20 or something. But yeah, it's hard. I'm sorry about that. It's hard to get his stuff.
It shouldn't be, because I think it's great. And it's definitely up there with some of the best modern Lovecraft stuff that I've read.
I agree. Lord Marduk writes, when Patton mentioned he worked at a movie theater taking tickets, I was hoping Chris or Chad would have mentioned that Lovecraft was spotted by a friend of a friend working a booth in Providence once.
Mm.
I have yet to see any acknowledgement in a Lovecraft letter or anything other than speculation. Mm. He might have considered the employment not worth mentioning in his circle of friends or a bit embarrassing.
Oh.
Seems like a good job, as with only one showing, he would have had 15 minutes or so selling tickets, and then he could just read between movies.
Yeah.
I never heard of that, but apparently a few folks have mentioned that at one point.
I've never heard of that either.
A job like that. But I would see that he probably wouldn't be bragging about it.
Ethan Cordray says, it reminds me of what True Detective did with a sort of post-agricultural, industrially poisoned landscape of Louisiana and the poverty and corruption-driven social dysfunctions of that milieu. I think adding a dose of weird fiction to gritty urban drama can both connect those very human problems to a wider sense of metaphysical disturbance and also provide some distance for an outside audience to be able to consider these sorts of stories without turning away out of mere disgust and lack of empathy.
Yeah, agreed.
Yeah.
That is a good comparison. I think True Detective did a lot of this same kind of thing. They take the mythos a lot in different game systems and novels and collections and that sort of thing. And they cross genres with it. So there's going to be a science fiction Cthulhu and there's a 1890s Cthulhu, etc.
Sure.
But just real world, real problems Cthulhu, I think, is just as legit. You know, when there's not a military angle, there's not a science fiction or steampunk angle, and it's straight up poverty, political insurrection, living in the city.
Yeah.
I think it's a cool environment for all of that. Frank Bailey writes, trying to work out how anybody ever became a cultist. I always felt the same, but after reading Call of Cthulhu a couple of years back, I was thinking about the backwoods half-breeds who are naturally drawn to evil trope. And it hit me that if I were one of these downtrodden, hated, and abused mixed-race people, denied an education or a future, and forced to live like an animal in the swamp, I would be utterly ripe for the picking by someone who came along and offered me some real power over the man.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of dreams of big dark shapes stomping through New Orleans getting revenge, and I'm in. And once you're in, the mental power of the entity keeps you there even when things get all obscene and horrific at the weekly service.
Oh.
It's almost as if HP got it right about their susceptibility to the cult, but didn't consider that there might be reasons.
Mm.
I realize this is a kind of mental retconning,
yeah.
And HP probably never would have given such a sympathetic reading to these people, but it certainly seems to make sense.
Yeah.
This story gave me the same feeling. There is logic to evil. There are reasons people do these things.
Yeah.
A very astute comment, yeah.
Very astute comment, and I can't wait for Frank to pick up a book that I can announce. I'm going to announce it right here our show. I have written a Call of Cthulhu role-playing game supplement book with Chaosium. Mike Mason of Chaosium is editing it, and it'll hopefully be out next year, I'm hoping. I can't make any promises on that yet because we're still doing lots of editing here behind the scenes, but it's called Cults of Cthulhu, and it's about using cults and building cults for your games and making long-term antagonists so that you can kind of really deep dive into what makes a cult work and how it functions and the personalities within them. And he actually touches on quite a bit of the stuff that I have in that book in his comments. So I think that that's pretty cool.
That's awesome, man. And I assume that if you don't play Call of Cthulhu, this supplement would also be good if you just, like, say, wanted to start a cult.
If you want to start a cult, it's definitely a good how-to guide on that.
Excellent.
But if you're not a role player, I think there's a lot of good material in there. There's some fiction as well, like that you can, you know, just read kind of for the fun of it. But also if you want to write a cult in one of your stories, if you're a fiction writer, it's a good tool for that as well, I think.
There you go. Well, congratulations on that. I'm glad you can finally announce it.
Thank you very much. I've been working on it for a while, and I'm glad I could finally bring it up. But keep your ears peeled, and as things develop, I'll share more news.
Speaking of excellent books, Kevin Roy writes, "Damn it, you got me reading Pimp. Thank you bastards for recommending this." I recommend it to everybody. I mean, it might be offensive to it's. There's a lot of brutal stuff in that book.
Oh, yeah.
I wouldn't want it to come off that we're advocating pimping or anything.
No.
Like that. It's just an interesting sociological study more than
anything. Yeah, he's not a good guy at all.
No.
He's a bad person, and we're not glorifying him at all, but it's very insightful. It just illuminated a lot of things for me, being a kind of a naive white dude from the Midwest.
Yeah, well, I think it works on the the street level, and that it says, hey, this is how pimps and prostitutes work together in a way, which I didn't really understand.
No,
but on a deeper level, I think it really exposes capitalism. This is basically what the system is on all levels.
Wow.
Really, I think it's a good guidebook to capitalism. James Duffy also wrote, when at the end of the show, you thanked Patton for introducing you to Michael Shea, I did wonder if this meant that you had both borne witness for him. Soon you two will be seeking out blood money on the streets and getting in on the hustle.
I've got my blood money already.
Whoa, really?
Don't ask how I got it. Not important. Okay. But if anybody wants to witness for me, just send me a direct message on Twitter.
That's right.
So episode 419, a very old man with enormous wings. Mm. Clara Meath says, don't worry, Chad. Every time you make a joke, I say, that Chad Pfeiffer is no angel.
Yes. I just want to know somebody said it at least once. I appreciate that, Clara.
Then she says, but seriously, I love this episode, and it hit on briefly a horror theme I've been seeing a bit more of lately in comics like Magnolia's Lord Baltimore and the like, where crustaceans, rather than the more typical cephalopods, are the aesthetic of doom, decay, and general nautical weirdness. It may be just my predilection, but I felt such a tone of unease throughout this story just because it started with such an unpleasant idea as a profusion of indoor crabs.
Yeah, it's pretty gross. And Lord Baltimore, a good name check, because I love those comic books.
Yeah, those are pretty fun.
And the novel that they are based on. I recommend everybody check those out.
Yeah, I thought that novel was great. I got that by accident. You recommended Baltimore to me. I thought right. I was getting the first trade paperback graphic novel. And then what came was this book. I was like, oh, but there's some drawings. There's Magnolia drawings in there. So I was like, well, you know, I'll give it a few pages. And I just flew through it, man. It's some solid, weird fiction. And it's set in the period of most of the things that we cover. So it really felt like something that we would talk about on our show. Obviously, the writers are still alive, so we cannot talk about it. But no. On this comment show, I can recommend it. I thought it was really good.
Well, I haven't read the book yet. You sent it to me, actually. So I'm looking forward to reading that. I just read the graphic novels. One of the first ones is dedicated to William Hope Hodgson.
Uh-huh.
And it features the invading fungus from a few of his stories, which was always scary. It's just good. If you're a fan of weird fiction, you'll like Baltimore.
Yeah.
Enough said. Elizabeth Parcells, I believe I'm pronouncing that right. Elizabeth, we just quoted her on the show the other day, actually. She writes, I've heard that crabs can end up being a nuisance in certain island towns, especially if the town is in the trajectory of a migratory path. Try searching for crabs invading town or crab migrating through town instead of crab infestation. To get some interesting imagery. Ha ha. And then David M. Jacobs followed up on Twitter to say the same thing he wrote. The trick is to Google crab migration.
There we go.
Yeah. And then he sent an article that was about a crab migration in Colombia that the Colombian army is dispatched to protect. It's this Caribbean island, Providencia, which is part of Colombia.
Mm-hmm.
Very underdeveloped, rarely visited by tourists, although that's increasing now. About 6,000 people there. But once a year, the military comes to this island. And they protect this army of black crabs that come out of the woods and migrate to the sea so they can breed.
Oh, whoa.
Because the crabs are so important to their local economy.
Ah, yes.
They're a delicacy. It's part of their identity. You know, it's very important. But one paragraph struck me. It says, they're interviewing somebody about this native to that island. And he says that every child growing up on the island remembers a first encounter with the crabs. If your parents want you to do something and you don't, they'll say the crabs will get you. And then you'll obey them immediately. But pretty soon you understand they're not aggressive and you start to admire them. Jay recalls learning how to catch the crabs as a child with his hands without getting hurt and having to remove them from his home by the bucketful.
Oh, wow.
There are just millions and millions of newborn crabs everywhere, he adds. They can be as small as a mosquito.
Oh, all right. So it's a real thing.
It's a real thing. And our author being from Colombia was probably something that he was familiar with. And this might happen in other locations. They're starting to get, I don't know what the word is, but like overfished a bit. People are capturing too many of them. So it's important that they keep them protected. But yes, it's true. You can have a crab invasion in your home. Somebody else sent an article about crabs invading the Bay of Pigs in Cuba. It was also a good read. Some people did the research for you.
I'm learning stuff. Sanjay Matthew says, regarding the priest refusing to accept the legitimacy of the angel, the characters are Roman Catholic. In Father Gonzaga's cosmology, the authority of the church derives directly from Christ through Peter and his heirs, the popes. Any legitimate communication from God to the world should therefore come in a form recognizable as such by the church. It's not as if the angel outranks church authority. After all, they're just messengers of God without free will. Since this supposed angel isn't communicating with a representative of the church in a way the church can recognize, it must ipso facto not be a legitimate messenger.
Interesting.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
The Roman Catholic Church is way more strict on the codes than the Galactic Empire. No, it's an old angel, but it still checks out here. As you point out, the priest's belief is predicated on faith. It's accepting any old angel that would be a compromise of that faith.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Once you've got the rules set for you, if something violates them, it doesn't mean you're going to change your rules at all.
Right.
I guess what he's, you know, that yeah. because they're Roman Catholics. Mark Brett writes, I always thought this story was more a surrealistic farce than anything else, a satire of human nature. Presented with something strange and otherworldly, people either drag it down into the mundane by gawking at it, abusing it, and trying to make a buck off of it, or they invest it with too much divinity in the hope of improving their own lives by seeking healing or an end to various strange afflictions. Meanwhile, the church completely rejects the old man's divinity because he doesn't speak a couple of dead languages. They're so wrapped up in their own dogma that they don't even try to understand him. And that, I think, is the ultimate point. Nobody really tries to understand who or what the old man is. They all just see him through the lens of their own self-interest.
Mm.
Love that. And I think that was the point that maybe I wasn't getting out of it.
Yeah.
I think that's exactly it.
Yeah.
I know that they've asked him questions and they throw some things at him, try to see what kind of food he likes. But are they really trying to understand what's going on with this guy?
Yeah, it does not seem important to them.
No.
It's like they just go, well, it's this. And then they go on and do whatever it is that they're going to do anyway. Yeah, good point. Thanks, Mark. Aaron Gardner says, I love Marquez's work. I was so excited when I saw you guys were going to talk about this story. Thanks to you guys, I have it in my mind that Footloose ends with everyone turning into spiders in this alternate timeline. In that timeline, all movies that have dance plots to save the rec center and that sort of thing end with a mass spider transformation.
Yes.
Lambada, You Got Served. And of course, break into Electric Boogaloo.
Mm-hmm.
It's that timeline's version of a morality play. Black Swan plays out pretty much the same way, except she turns into a crazy ballerina spider instead of a swan.
I think those revisions would be excellent for all of those movies.
I would love to see all of those films.
You're hired to produce those. You got the job.
You got the job. You're going to have to figure out the financing.
Well, you got to do it all on your own, but I just want to let you know you're now the producer of these remakes of all these dance movies.
Congratulations.
Don't disappoint us. Don't contact us again until they're all done. David Azzaghetti, piggybacked on that to write, also Footloose with giant spider transformation would have to be titled Feet Loose. Come on, that's a good one. I like that.
I do like that one. Alison Albright says, P.S. Being turned into a tarantula the size of a ram would be awesome. It might be harder to make new friends, but that's really the only downside I can see.
That's the only downside I can see. Alison is funny as always. That's a good one.
Oh, Alison, you treasure.
Ben Mund wrote, loved this show, and as far as the realism part goes, I have directly experienced a very old man with enormous ears, so that's pretty close.
Close enough for me.
A few people mentioned that, actually, because... That is what happens. It's happening to me, I'm sure, slowly. All the old men in my family have gigantic ears. That's the realism part of it. There's no magic.
Sure.
There were a lot of great comments on Three Skeleton Key, but I don't think we're going to get to them in this show. But thanks again, everybody, for writing in. You're all hilarious and insightful. And
oh, my God, yeah.
I love having this relationship with you.
We got the best listeners. I'm not exaggerating at all. It's totally true. You guys, this is a wonderful community. I think you're all super cool.
I like you folks.
I like you guys, too. It's true.
Right.
We got a great team.
We do. And that's all we have for this week. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackey, and you've been listening to the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast Comments Show.
That's right, only on Patreon. Thanks for tuning in.